Morning.
Morning.
I need to read all that.
Huh? What? I don't have that agenda in front of me, so.
The chair of the Arizona State wants so much.
Might as well.
Okay. There's the right to change the order and items on the agenda except for public.
Sorry. And upon a vote of the majority of the quorum, the board may go into executive session to obtain legal advice for the board's attorneys pursuant to Arizona Revised Statutes 38-431.03A3 on any items listed on the agenda. All meeting attendees whose presence is not required in the executive session may remain in the board meeting when the board withdraws to chambers for the executive session. Any and all legal action will be take place in the open session. Call to order. We did that. Roll call.
Emily Clark.
Victoria Bowman.
John Ortega.
Earl Dusky. Present. Presentation by Assistant Attorney General Mary D. Williams on regulatory board meeting procedures for statutory compliance.
All right. Good morning. And Michael's going to help me out here. We're going to kind of tag team this. We put it into about three or four different parts, and we probably won't go through every page just because I know you have an hour. So you are all welcome to read a lot of it on your own, and then if you ever have any questions, just give me a call or Michael a call, and we're happy to expand on anything. If you have questions when we go along, go ahead and ask them. It's probably easier that way. Does everyone have the PowerPoint that's on the TV screen right there? So I'm going to start with that and go over. This document has actually been around our office for a very long time. Former Assistant Attorney General Nancy Beck prepared this years ago. I don't know if any of you are familiar with her. Tom may remember her. So she was awesome and an expert on board meetings and open meeting law and public records. So she prepared this, and we've revised it over the years as we need to, but it's been a staple. So we're going to go through that. Basically, this first document is just kind of based on, obviously, the governing statutes, but just basically on experience from all of us doing these, covering these board meetings for so long. I'm just going to go through the slides. I'm not going to do it on the computer, so I'm going to go to page 2. And basically from that one, we just like to start with this quote, administrative law is not for sissies, so you should lean back, clutch the sides of your chairs, and steel yourselves for this job you do, which is a very important job, and all of you do a great job at it. But it is an important part of our society and our regulatory environment. Pretty much of what... how boards operate is parliamentary procedure, meaning you gather together, you have to have a quorum, you make motions, those motions are seconded, you discuss, and you take your action. Most agencies follow more of an informal parliamentary procedure. A few of our boards have in statute or rule that they follow Robert's rules. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that. If you don't have it, you know, we don't strictly follow it because we like things to, you know, make sure you get everything discussed that you want to get discussed, and we do it a little more informally.
Let me jump in real quick. I'd say a common question I see from all kinds of boards is, do we need a motion for that, or can we discuss this until a motion has been made? And as Mary noted, there's not really, at least, and your board isn't one of those that has explicitly adopted Robert's Rules of Order, so there's no law that says one way or the other, and so we'll try and address those situations as they come about. But it's good. That question means you're thinking about process, which is good. Mm-hmm. But there's not always an answer. My default is always, if you wonder if you need a motion, it probably won't take that long to do one, and staff usually likes to have it for a clear direction from the board. So that's a parliamentary question that comes up.
And I agree with that because you're never going to get in trouble for doing a motion, but if you don't do one, it may be something that would need to come back to you because it wouldn't be have any effect. So there's another quote from Thomas Jefferson. When you're conducting your proceedings, no one is to disturb another in his speech by hissing, coughing, spitting, speaking, or whispering to one another, nor to stand up or interrupt him. So just kind of basic common decency when your fellow board members are speaking, allow him or her to finish their comments, and then feel free to, can always disagree, but in a respectful way.
Well, she's turning, I'll throw something out there. So you also have audio recorded meetings. Mm-hmm. A lot of times that's, you know, the main record if anyone wants to hear what happens. And not speaking over each other or being wait on to your call. You know, Mr. Chair, and the chair will call you. Board Member Bowman, not only does that mean it's clear she has the floor, but it also creates a good audio record of knowing who's speaking and there's no two people speaking at the same time.
And eventually you might have video meetings, so everyone can look forward to that. We have on page 5 some general functions of the board chair. So a lot of agencies have the view that the chair doesn't vote. And at least in my experience with my client agencies, the chair does vote. Again, you're not governed by Robert's rules, so we do like the chair to participate. The functions of the chair, basically, you know, facilitating the meeting, assisting the board, staying on task, keeping control. If somebody gets disruptive, the chair should step in and try to ask that person to, you know, calm down, or they'll be asked to leave. Chair obviously calls the agenda items. The executive director can do that as well. That's just a preference, how boards want to do it. There's no hard and fast rule on that. Do you have anything to add on the chair responsibilities?
No, you know, you also get the question of whether a chair can make a motion. It is kind of common for the chair not to make motions in meetings. Parliamentary rule that applies. I see it a lot of times in other boards for the more procedural steps. If no one's making a motion and it's a simple matter, sometimes the chair would say, okay, well, on the chair's motion, you know, just to get the matter moving. But it is kind of common for the chair to defer to the other board members in the making of the motion.
I agree. All right, on page 6, starting the meeting, obviously your chair just went through that, and that is the right way to do that. You all are aware, I think, you can't start your meeting any earlier than it's posted. Oftentimes you might have a little bit of a delay if you're waiting for a quorum, and that's okay. If you have time-specific items on your agenda, same rule applies. If you have a board hearing set for 10 o'clock, but you see everybody's here, you can't start it at 9:45. Just because everyone's present. If it's posted for 10, it has to start at 10 or after.
And I just add quickly to that is you have a few people that you're interested in the time, it's the participants in the matter, but also the public. Someone from the public may have wanted to hear that, and you might say, well, the parties are all here, but maybe someone who's going to show up and just listen from the audience would kind of an open meeting issue as well as a due process.
Going to page 7, with boards like yours where you have, I think you have 5 members when everybody's present and appointed, your quorum is 3. If you know in advance you're not going to make it to a meeting, please let the executive director or staff know, because if you get, you know, too many and you can't reach that magic number of 3, then the meeting will be canceled. And it's better to know that in advance than to gather everybody here and all of a sudden, you know, only 2 of you show up, and then the public's here. And so it's just easier if everyone knows in advance whether or not you have to cancel it. There is another common misconception that I get this question. I've been doing this for many, many, many years, and I still get the question, well, if we don't have a quorum, can we just talk about things but not vote? If you don't have a quorum, you cannot do anything. So that's something that, I don't know where that comes from, but people will always challenge us on, well, just let us talk about it, and, you know, we won't make any motions, but that's not allowed.
And just after this meeting, you'll be down to three members for some period of time, which means it's going to be critical that if you don't think you can make it to a meeting, that'll mean you can't have a meeting and you'll have to scramble and try and maybe find another time that works for the three.
And following up on that, when you only have three present during your meeting, if anyone needs a break, don't get up and just walk out like you could if you had five, because then you lose your quorum and everything has to stop. So, you know, raise your hand and just say to the chair, can we take a five-minute recess? And go from there. And if you're on the phone, sorry. If you're doing a telephonic meeting ever, again, you have your bare quorum, I'll have the executive director make sure you're checking in every so often, because with cell phones today, people drop off. And I did a meeting one time with three, which was a quorum, and halfway through it, we discovered somebody had dropped off, so we had to start over. So telephonic meetings are not my favorite on a good day, but when you have your bare quorum there, it's just really important that you announce yourself and, you know, participate, so that way we know that you're on the phone.
That occurred to me recently in a meeting that had a bare quorum during a hearing, and halfway through the hearing we realized someone had missed some portion of it, and we had to cancel and start the entire hearing over the following month because you couldn't just pick it up and fix it.
All right, moving to page 8, continuing on, just kind of getting your meeting going. You did the roll call, which we do recommend as best practice at the beginning. If somebody is not present, you should note that for the record. If a board member leaves early, if you think of it as best practice to say, you know, board member Ortega has left the meeting, and then that will go in the minutes, and the public knows who continued to be present and who didn't. On the same page, just maintaining order, some tips, you know, avoid side conversations with each other during a meeting, avoid, you know, having someone look at your screen to chit-chat about something that's on there, and that's for two reasons. One, as Michael said, everything's audio recorded, and we want to pick up the comments. If it's not something you don't want to say on the tape, then you probably shouldn't say it anyway. And it just gives an appearance that you're conducting some business that, you know, that you don't want the public to know about. Obviously, one person speaks at a time. Don't interrupt. Don't talk over each other. Page 9, dealing with disruptions. Again, the chair controls the meeting. You've probably all had meetings where somebody might get a little loud in the audience. The open meeting law allows the public to attend and listen, on some occasions to speak, but they don't have the right to just stand up and speak on every item. That you have a call to the public, which allows for that period of time somebody can come and speak to you on any topic that they want to. If you have somebody who continues to be disruptive, then they can be asked to leave the meeting. You give them a warning, and if they're not going to listen to you, then the open meeting law allows them to be removed.
For both board members and staff, there's been occasions, not that I've experienced with this board, but other boards, where you know you have a personality type that has caused trouble in the past, or there's some sort of reason for being, you know, careful of your safety. There is security in the staff, and it is possible to have an off-duty or an on-duty police officer in the meeting, or the security staff in the meeting with advance coordination. So there are steps. If you don't feel safe, make sure you let somebody know, and they can arrange to have a presence of some kind here to deter, prevent any problems.
Page 11 starts with proceeding with the agenda, and we've touched on a couple things. Basically, the rule of thumb is if it's not on your agenda, you don't get to talk about it, other than to ask staff to put it on for a future agenda. When the chair calls the agenda items, it's best practice to actually say, okay, we're moving to agenda item 2, which is discussion of board rules, rather than just saying next item. If you have somebody in the public who doesn't have a copy of your agenda, they're going to get lost. Michael touched on this a little bit. When you're speaking, you know, use your names, treat each other respectfully. A lot of what you do is based on public perception. And they're going to be watching what you do and say. We have something in here, eating during a board meeting looks bad. And I know everyone likes a snack once in a while, especially early in the morning. And this kind of a discussion on training isn't, you know, as big of a deal. But if you're doing a hearing, probably, you know, the parties want to see you fully engaged and not having a snack. Big part of what you'll probably notice your attorney's doing when you're taking a break, please don't talk about the case that you just decided or a case that's coming up or any item. The breaks are time just to leave the room and not conduct any board business. So I'm sure you've had Michael or other attorneys, you know, scold you for that when you're in the break room. Everyone does it, but we, that's definitely something that is discouraged and not allowed by the open meeting law.
Especially just because even just two of you commenting on a hearing now, following,
right.
You know, when you only have three after this meeting, you'll have
a meeting.
Even if it's in passing, just, you know, a comment, it could probably not happen.
Page 13. Is when people come and appear before you, obviously treat them with respect and dignity. Don't scold them. Even if you disagree with what they did, you know, give them their time to speak. And the same for them. They owe you respect as well.
Ma'am. Your page numbers are not the same as ours.
Are they not the same? Oh, how about if I do it by slide?
Well,
slide 25.
Yeah, that would be good.
That work? Okay, sorry about that.
Thank you.
I forget that on board materials. Thanks, Victoria. All right, during a meeting in today's world, everybody's got their cell phone and computers and tablets. Best practice is turn them off, obviously, as you would want the audience to do. Don't answer your phone during a meeting, which I think everybody probably knows is not a good thing to do. Don't read or send emails or text messages, even if it's too... If it's an emergency, obviously, you know, maybe you have to do it or take a break. But it just, again, looks bad. If you're doing a hearing or somebody's up here presenting or answering questions about their application, if you're texting on your phone, even if it's completely unrelated, it's going to look like they're going to automatically assume that you're talking about them. So that's, we ask that you don't do it. And then the big one is do not conduct any internet research on a case during a meeting or a hearing. So if Michael's presenting a hearing and the other side's here and somebody raises some kind of new idea that you hadn't heard about before, don't get on your computer and look it up. That's if something, you know, you would need additional information on that can be accomplished in a different way. And this probably comes up a little later, but the main goal, when you make a decision, everyone has to have the same information. So you don't want Mr. Ortega having done a bunch of research and his decision is going to be something the rest of the board members don't have.
I have an appeal pending on a current case for a different board where that's one of the allegations. A board member introducing facts that weren't in the record that we disagree with the allegation, but the allegation is that he investigated it himself and presented, you know, extra information that wasn't... hearing. It can actually become a ground for reversing your decision.
Right. Okay, I'm on slide 28, talking about abstentions. So we're going to get into a little bit about abstentions and recusals. Abstention is when you just don't want to vote on something. Maybe you're uncomfortable about it. You just don't want your vote being on the record. And again, that's not good practice at all. Actually one of my big pet peeves. However, if you come into a hearing or an agenda item late and you don't feel like you have all the information, you weren't here to hear some of the information presented, then absolutely abstaining is okay. When you have an abstention, it's still counted towards the majority. So you don't lose your quorum if you abstain, as you would with a recusal. So again, given your bare bones, if you feel like you have to abstain, then go ahead and abstain. Do you have anything to add on that?
Yeah, well, on slide 28, there's something that says, you know, the cases are difficult to decide, and it wasn't meant for this board, but it's really fitting here, which is sometimes the only evidence in a case is a he said, she said. Mm-hmm. Accept that and make the best decision based on your judgment of credibility. In our world, that's all we have, our he said, she said cases. No, I think we have two types of cases. We have the type of case where the parties disagree that anything of the nature of what's being alleged has happened. And then you have cases where it's an interpretation of what happened. So I think there are times where, you'd say, I believe there was no intent for what happened, whereas the other party thought there was intent. But then you have cases where it's, did this happen or did it not? And I think, at least from my perspective, that it's a correct choice. But once you decide, and you have to decide, did this thing happen or did it not, then that's the fact you found. So if it was, was the light red, if you decide, yes, it was red, it's red. And, if it was sexual activity with a client and another person said there's no sexual activity, once you decide there was, you've decided that fact. And I see a lot of times in a lot of boards, because it was a close fact, they'll act like they hadn't really found the fact. But once you decide, hey, I believe this fact is true, then I think you need to accept that. That's the decision you made. One of the preponderance standard, 51%. And then you move forward with that fact, is my advice. Instead of maybe second-guessing yourself. But unfortunately, you probably have one of the harder hearing jobs of any licensing board, because every time there's only two people who know what happened. And we've yet to have the case where they exactly agreed. And you're going to have to keep living in that world.
Okay, moving on. Slide 29 and 30. This basically just, your meetings will go a lot smoother if you are all familiar with your powers and duties, what you can and cannot do, and all your statutes and rules, which I, based on my limited experience with all of you, I think you all do a really great job with that. So that's not a problem. Related to that is, come to your meetings prepared. I like to tell, I won't name any names, but I used to, years ago, there was a board member who was in the days before the electronic information, so everything was transmitted in big binders and big bins that were zip-tied, and this particular board member would come to the meetings often with the zip ties still intact. So it was obvious that the individuals had not read anything. It's not helpful if you're not prepared.
Your packets are pretty well organized, as you know. I just would remind you, in case you didn't notice, but at the bottom of your table of content on the left-hand side of your bookmarks, you have the statutes and rules available to you throughout the meeting. So you can look those up at any time without going on the internet or bringing your own separate statutes and rules. They're in your packet.
Right. Slide 31, obviously, I think you all know this. Your primary duty is you have two functions. You license applicants, and then you regulate licensees. The two primary functions. Slide 32 and 33 I highlighted because I do think that's a really important, I'm just going to read it and then it's pretty self-explanatory, but it holds true today as well. Public officials may not violate the plain terms of a statute because in their opinion better results will be attained by doing so. They have but one duty, and that is to enforce the law as it is written. And if the effect of their action is disastrous, the responsibility is upon the legislature and not upon them. But if they knowingly, even though with the best intentions in the world, violate the law, they and their bondsmen must take the consequences. One of the reasons I like it is because I'm not sure what a bondsman is or if anyone has them anymore. But beware. This comes up a lot when somebody maybe doesn't meet the technical requirements of your licensing statutes, and you feel bad for them, you really want to help them get a license, and unfortunately, if there's no exception in your statutes or rules, you can't read one into it. So basically what this says is, you have to apply it the way it is, and it's the legislature that needs to change it if it's not a good law. But it's hard when somebody's here in front of you and, you know, they want a license. You want them to have a license, but they just don't meet the criteria. You just can't give it to them. Or it could work in the reverse as well. But your job is to follow the law.
There's time. I mean, you can do this at the meeting to say, hey, I'd like to have a further discussion about that statute that a case might have highlighted as inadequate mm-hmm. for some reason to you. And you can have that discussion in a future meeting. I think it's somewhere else in the packet, but it's not the time during the hearing where you see this statute you don't like to talk about the value of the statute. That's effectively irrelevant during the hearing. And it could give the impression that you might have decided a case just because you didn't like the law. So I'd say also try and reserve your commentary on the quality of the statute during the matter where it's at issue. You can certainly bring it up, but it's better as its own agenda item to discuss an amendment.
Okay, I'm going to probably skip ahead a little bit because we want to fit in some other areas. So slide 34 starts with resolving complaints, and again, I think all of you understand the process. One of the main things, obviously, be familiar with grounds for discipline and what constitutes unprofessional conduct.
Ivan, real quick, one element on slide 35 is one of your steps is you can always continue a matter if you have questions and you want to request further investigation. Mm-hmm. You're not... You get these cases pretty quick. There's plenty of time to resolve them and still be in a reasonable amount of time to resolve a case. So if you have a question, ask it. If it needs staff to go find something, they'll do it. So don't be shy to say, I need this answer before I can move it to the next stage or whatever.
All right. slide 38, we touched on this a little bit. Again, don't do your own research on a case when you're getting ready for it, not just during the board meeting, but before the board meeting. Those of you that are from the industry, you are put on this board for your expertise, and you obviously can apply that expertise during a board meeting. So you don't have to have an expert witness in every hearing. But there's kind of a balance you have to do. You apply your own expertise, but that doesn't mean you go out and do a bunch of research on your own to become an expert. You know, you can always, work with your investigators. And again, if you need more information, you just ask for it. When you have slide 39 talks about what we call priors. So if someone has prior disciplinary history with you, that information comes into play at the point where you've determined in the case that's in front of you that there's been a violation. So if you have a hearing, you go through all the evidence, you're deliberating, you say, yes, we believe the evidence proves that there was unprofessional conduct and a violation, and you vote on that, then at that point you can consider the person's previous discipline. But what you can't do is say, well, this person's been before us before, we know this person, obviously, you know, they did it. So that's just something that's... You know, we try to make sure that nobody's prejudiced because that's what it would be. They could argue that you were biased and prejudiced because of prior times before the board. We want to avoid that as a ground for appeal. All right. Slide 41, the basic point for that is just be consistent. You've probably heard, you know, Michael and other attorneys, when you're making a decision, just try to be consistent in the way that you've ruled before on cases. Obviously, every case is going to be a little different, and, you know, you do have to decide it on its own merits. But if you put someone on probation for a certain type of violation and another person comes before you with the same conduct, absent any, you know, prior disciplinary history, probably not a good idea to revoke that person. And what that does is it can result in a court finding that you are arbitrary and capricious. So you to the best you can, you try to be consistent.
And if there are distinguishing factors or aggravating factors in a given case, and you might even know, hey, normally we'd only do a probation, articulate the difference that case might have in your motion for whatever discipline that might be exceeding or less than a prior case or different or a similar case. If you just create that record, it will support that there was a reason you changed from what the norm was.
Slide 42, and this just applies probably more to all of you because you do the own your own hearings and you're acting as the administrative law judge. At the point when the board members can ask questions and you don't feel like the witness gave you an answer, there's nothing wrong with following up and making sure you get the answer. Because witnesses are going to, if they don't want to give you the answer, they're going to dance around it. But something to be in tune with that, there's nothing wrong with following up and asking them to please answer your question. All right. I'm going to skip. Let's go to slide 47. This is just kind of making motions, some tips on making motions. We talked about the chair already, generally not, but there's nothing that prohibits it absolutely. The one takeaway that I want to just emphasize on making motions, and it happens a lot with every board, try to avoid saying, like, so moved. After someone says, the chair may say, so can I have a motion to do X, Y, and Z? Even though it's obvious what you're moving, best practice is to say, I move that, and be specific with the motion, not I motion that or I move that. Because you want a clear record, again, for the public.
And if you know you're concocting a kind of a complicated motion or it's a consent agreement that had a lot of terms and maybe be the one to volunteer this after you've heard the discussion. There's no problem. Ask staff. Hopefully, staff or your attorney have taken notes on what the basic structure of that motion was, and they can say, "Can you repeat that back to me?" Then, ideally, take your own notes as that's repeated back to you, and then you'll repeat it yourself. That'd be the best practice to have you actually say the terms rather than so. That's not uncommon. It's not something that this board alone has done. Happens.
Yeah. Question. So under 6, announcing the result of the vote, would you say unanimous in favor or 3-4 and 1 against or motion denied?
Best practice, if it's unanimous, motion passes, none opposed. If you have some nays in there, you say motion passes, two opposed, and under the current law, you need to say who the board members are that opposed it.
Okay.
So last year, there was a provision added to the open meeting law for minutes, and now it requires that each board member's, the way they voted, get recorded. Now, to avoid having to do a roll call on every single motion that you do, the way I do it, and I think a lot of us do it, that's why we do a roll call in the beginning, and you note who's not present at the meeting, because that way, if it's unanimous, people can obviously figure out who was there and who voted. But when you have recusals or abstentions or nay votes, then you should announce that after the vote's taken, so that can be recorded in the minutes.
One practice that's kind of common at this board is the terminology "so moved" after a motion is passed, and I would just say it somehow took hold here, but at the appropriate. Thing would be to say, motion passes, motion fails.
Yep. Some basic principles on motions. Obviously, if you don't get a second, it doesn't go anywhere. Motion dies. If you have a tie vote, motion fails, and you need to, someone needs to make another motion. I have had it where, especially if you have an even number, you might go a couple rounds with, you get a tie vote, and we usually encourage board to the extent, it's kind of like with a hung jury, you keep talking, see if you can persuade somebody. If you can't and it's clear at some point, then you're going to have to just table the matter till you get an extra person that'll break the tie. It doesn't happen a lot, but every once in a while. When you have, again, if you're following Robert's rules, the procedure is someone makes a motion, somebody seconds it, and then you can have discussion. But again, this is more informal. So I've had a lot of boards say, "Well, we can't discuss it till somebody makes a motion." I don't follow that rule. My goal is always to get a decision made on as much discussion and as much information. So I don't think there's a hard and fast rule on that. Stay focused on the discussion at hand. try to not weave off into other topics. I'm just going to kind of go through because I know Mike, we want to get to some other things. So a lot of this is just common sense right now. Don't interrupt. We talked about. We talked about roll call. Obviously, you can't have any secret voting, any absentee votes. If you know you're not going to be, you can't call in and say, hey, Mr. Chair, vote yes for me on this particular item. It would make it a lot easier, but it's not allowed. Talked about that. We talked about phone calls. Slide 66 is recusals. So there's and
54 real quick.
54. Yep.
Yeah,
go
so
ahead.
If there's no second, because a lot of times somebody will put a motion to the board and then it's really not seconded at that moment. So do we just give it a certain amount of time?
If you don't get a second?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It usually becomes kind of obvious that nobody's going
to
second it.
You actually have to rescind the motion? If it's
just still die on its own if you don't get a second.
Okay.
So, if Mr. Ortega says, I move that we grant licensure and nobody seconds it, then.
I always thought we had to, take the motion off the board. Yeah, off the table.
That sometimes will happen after you've had the second and you're discussing, and maybe the second has a change of heart. Or it becomes clear that maybe that wasn't the right motion to make, then, the motion maker can say, I withdraw my motion. The second withdraws the second. But if you don't get a second at all, it just doesn't go anywhere.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
You're welcome. Let's talk about recusals just really quick. There's two types. You have a statutory duty to recuse yourself from participating in a board matter if you have a pecuniary or proprietary interest in the matter that's before you. The obvious ones are, your business partner or your employee comes before you, your employer. Those are obvious ones. Family members come before you. Then you need to recuse. And recusal means that you do not participate in any way in the board discussion. We like to say it's best practice to get up and leave the table, take the opportunity to go take a break. Now, when you have three, that presents a problem. So if you know you're going to have to recuse yourself on a matter that's on an agenda, let your executive director know that in advance, and that matter can probably be taken off. Because there's no point in starting it and then a recusal happens because you're not going to be able to do anything with it. If you're recused, that means after the meeting you don't go up to another board member and talk about it. You're obviously not allowed in an executive session and you can't ask anybody what happened in executive session. So even though you're a board member and you have access to executive session minutes, if you're recused, you don't get that. If you leave the table, and you want to go sit in the audience, we just ask that you don't roll your eyes, make faces, sigh. Because that could be an emotional case where you have a strong feeling on it, but we don't want to see that. So it's just a good time to just remove yourself from the room. And if you happen to get the executive session minutes, which generally don't say a whole lot, but if you happen to get it in your packet, we try to advise that whoever's recused doesn't get that particular executive session minutes, but it happens. Just, we ask that you don't read them.
A quick note on that. It's often for me that I'll show up to meetings for all types of agencies where a person speaks to me right before the meeting in like the break room or out here in the meeting room about a recusal question. And I would say that always makes me nervous. I'll try and walk away because you might get board open meeting issues. There might be some confidence that you want to keep quiet. So I'd say, best practice, obviously, is look at your meeting materials in advance of the meeting enough time that you could get in touch with the assistant AG and ask your recusal question, not just right at the meeting. Also, with our quorum issues, if you do have some sort of recusal issue, we're going to need to know early so that it can be addressed on the agenda or maybe resolved. Maybe you don't have a reason to recuse after you discuss it, and we can keep a matter on the agenda. But if it's the morning of the meeting, it's probably too late. And sometimes, you might not know until you recognize someone or you hear something about their practice and, I used to have this relationship. that's fine.
Right.
But if you see it coming, let us know.
Yeah, and the easier questions for us to help you decide if you have to recuse are the statutory recusals, the statutory conflicts. The other kind of cases where you want to recuse is if you just you know somebody and you know you don't have that great of a prior relationship with them and you don't think you can be fair and impartial, or vice versa. You know, it's your best friend, which doesn't fit into a statutory conflict, but it's an appearance of impropriety if you participate in it. Those questions, when they're presented to us, are a little harder because we obviously can't get into your mind and how you feel. So don't get frustrated if we can't give you the exact answer and say, yes, you absolutely must recuse. Because some of them are not as obvious as others, but you have to do a little self-reflection and just say, can I look at this case with an open mind and be impartial? And if the answer is no, then we ask that you recuse.
Some larger boards, one of my common pieces of advice when someone does feel uncomfortable is, well, you know, we got a full board. If you really don't feel comfortable, it's not that big a deal. The matter will move forward, especially if it's not a big matter. When we have such a tight quorum, bare quorum, you know, my advice wouldn't be that, obviously, because if one of you doesn't participate, the matter may not be able to go forward.
And sometimes you can put it on the record. If you can say, you know, I do know Mr. So-and-so from, you know, prior years. However, I believe I can be fair and impartial. And if the others, if they want to object, they'll put the objection on the record.
Exactly, yeah.
But
if they waive that objection and you feel like you can decide it, then I personally don't have a concern moving forward if I was presenting the hearing that I'm going to have my result appealed. Because they've said on the record that they don't have a problem with you participating in. Better than after the fact, it never gets mentioned.
All right. Do you want to move on since we're getting low on time?
Yeah.
So let's go ahead. A lot of the rest of it is pretty self-explanatory. Call to the public, our role. Obviously, you know our role as Assistant Attorney General is to give you legal advice, and it's not always going to be what you want it to be. So, you know, our job is to tell you what the law is and give you your options. And then just one other thing when I was preparing for that, sometimes you'll hear us say, you know, that's a policy question that we can't advise on. And again, it's not because we're trying to be obstructive or anything. It's just our job is to give you the legal advice. Your job is to decide matters of policy. So you'll hear us say that. And it's not because we don't want to answer the question. It's just that we can't.
One place you might see AGs being a little more forceful or assertive is on open meeting law questions because the Office of the Attorney General enforces the open meeting law. So we're even more in tune with what's going on there and ultimately, I wouldn't say responsible, but, you know, if we ever had a dispute about the open meeting law, it's not like, you're not taking my advice, fine, so be it, I've given it to you. We'd actually have to take action, report it, maybe even leave the meeting if you're proceeding with an open meeting violation after we've advised you. So that's the one place I always find I'll really put my foot down.
You want to do the formal interview? Is that more helpful? And then this one, pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah, I don't even know if I have it. I'll just shoot.
Here, I have it.
Okay. As you know, we have formal interviews and formal hearings. You've seen enough of them that I think you have a pretty good idea of the difference between the two. Just to run you through the process, as you know, the board investigation gets completed. Andrew has his report, and the matter first appears on your agenda. Your initial discussion of that could be whether to, you know, pursue any further investigation. Otherwise, you have without the licensee agreeing to it, you can dismiss, file an advisory letter, issue a non-disciplinary order for continuing education. Also, at that time of the initial review, you can take actions as long as the licensee agrees via consent agreement. So instead of sending the matter or in addition to sending the matter to a formal interview or a hearing, you could offer a consent agreement. But that's up at that point to the licensee to agree. You can't impose discipline outside of a formal interview or a formal hearing and rare summary suspension. Not too long ago, we've kind of moved a little bit more towards offering consent agreements and if not accepted, proceed to formal interview. So so you're pretty familiar with that. I won't go into it, but that's one way to proceed and resolve a case before you even get to the formal interview. With formal interviews, and I'm going to skip a little bit, but with formal interviews, the licensee has to accept that. It's a lesser form of hearing. They have less due process rights. So if the licensee does not accept a formal interview or doesn't respond or explicitly rejects it, then the board must then proceed to formal hearing if it wants to impose discipline. On consent agreements, generally, the board offers them. If they're not accepted, it will proceed to the next stage, whatever that might be. And usually we have those alternative votes, you know, so we know that we know where it's going if the consent agreement's not accepted. You guys vote on the terms of those, and the attorney generals that are representing you and the staff will type up an order. There is some boilerplate stuff that isn't really substantive that's in every order, like, you know, this is the entire agreement, there's no other agreements, this agreement can only be modified by both parties, those sorts of things. But the best is if you can tell us explicitly every substantive term of that agreement, and staff can help remind you, hey, how much time do you want to give for that? Do you want that or that? But ultimately, staff and the AEGs can't insert terms. If you didn't put a civil penalty, we can't put a civil penalty. If you didn't, you know, I'll just leave it at that. If you didn't, how about you didn't describe the courses that you want someone to take, staff can't say, well, we'll make a communication. And so that's why we try and make sure we get all the details out for your consent agreement so that we can create that order. One thing that we haven't done a lot of, but it's something that we talked about, was staff negotiating outside of the meeting consent agreements that could be presented to you. There hasn't been a lot of that done here, but it is done at other boards where the way it essentially works is the licensee is notified, this is all subject to board approval. There really is no authority from the board to agree to anything, but it's a method of presenting you something that you can see and say, I agree with those terms explicitly. I don't think it's the preferred best way to do it. I mean, ideally it all happens in an open board meeting, but the saving part of it is nothing is signed, nothing's official until you agree to it. So if that happens a little more in the future, just give you a little thought about that. Formal interviews. All licensees have a right to due process. That comes from the 14th Amendment, that no state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Licensees have a property interest in their license. It's a thing that they own and possess. And so it can't be taken away by the government without giving someone a reasonable opportunity to be heard and to present their defenses and to know the nature of the allegations against them and to know in a reasonable amount of time when the hearing will take place and everything it will cover. Any sort of disciplinary action triggers due process rights directly. When you're doing something more like investigations or non-disciplinary stuff, it's a bit of a sliding scale. You have less due process expectations when you have no possible disciplinary action that impacts your property right under your license. You can't punish a licensee at all for exercising their due process rights. If a licensee says, I don't want your formal interview, you know, I want to go straight to a hearing, can't hold that against them. That's their right. And just be careful at anything in the public record that, you know, would penalize a licensee or cast any doubt on their factual claims because they're using their tools to cross-examine, to present documents, those sort of things, make motions to you as they may need to. Formal hearings, and that's, I didn't think I have anything else on formal interview. Formal interview, well, let me say this about formal hearings. You don't have an attorney advocate, like in a formal hearing where your AAG would switch chairs and present the matter to you. We would be here just to give you advice on the process and the procedures of conducting a formal interview. You know, the typical formal interview process would be to get a report from staff on the nature of the allegations. Most primarily from the licensee and to conduct an interface with that licensee. Sometimes you can hear from other people, but you know, that lesser formality. They can't present their own witnesses by right. They can't present their own documents like they can in a formal hearing where they have the rights to do that. It's a little less formal process. But because it's less formal, it's a little more flexible, but, you know, you've seen enough of them. I won't belabor it. Formal hearings, due process. Basically, the few points that I want to make there is, number one, they have the right to counsel. Again, you can't penalize them for that, and counsel can help. Sometimes we, on this side of the table, enjoy having an attorney help a licensee on the other side because it usually just promotes a more orderly process and a thorough hearing, and we're all out here in the interest of justice. We have this interesting role of at the assistant AG, as assistant AG, that advises the board that when a hearing happens, we change our hats, and you receive independent legal advice from a different attorney who has not had any communication with your normal attorney about the case. That helps the licensee with due process as well, because there's no ex parte communication. The attorney who's prosecuting the case can't speak to you about it outside of the hearing or give you any legal advice on it. And the attorney who's giving you legal advice can't have any communication with the attorney prosecuting the case. So sometimes you'll see that, you know, that's a question for your independent advisor, because you're so used to asking your usual assistant AG legal questions that it might be that you just say, oh, well, what's the answer? And, you know, that attorney will always defer to your independent advice attorney, and they might not agree. As you know, you would go into an executive session on something like that, you'd only have your independent attorney. Your normal attorney has to watch you leave and wonder, you know, just like everyone else, what might be going on in that executive session. Licensees can, you know, cross-examine any witness that the state presents. They can present their own evidence and their own witnesses. The state can obviously cross-examine them. You're pretty familiar with the formal hearing. It's something that's been going around a few boards, and this one in particular is the idea of formal interviews as mandatory steps before formal hearing or not. Your statute says that you may offer formal interviews. And the way that's been interpreted by our office is to say that it's one of your options at that stage of your complaint handling to either dismiss the case, file these non-disciplinary actions, or do a formal interview. It doesn't mean, even though it uses the word may, that you don't do the formal interview. Because when you get to the place in your statute, it's 4254, that says you can do formal hearings, it says if the licensee has accepted the formal interview and the results show that suspension or revocation may be in order, then you may go to formal hearing. Or if the licensee refuses the formal interview. So it's more of a predicate to the formal hearing that you have to conduct or attempt to conduct the formal interview or do some other non-disciplinary option. And so we're moving towards doing formal interviews or offering them at least, or, you know, offering consent agreements. If not accepted, go to formal interview as the routine practice. And I personally enjoy having a formal interview before I go to a hearing because formal interviews, as you know, would have under oath statements from the licensee about the matter at hand. And if we're going to go to a formal hearing because there may be suspension or revocation on the table, it's helpful at least to the prosecuting attorney and probably to the board, ultimately, to have had that person's story recorded before the hearing that you're going to go. And if they change their story or that can be presented back to them as an impeachment of their testimony in the hearing. You know, that's not what you said under oath at the formal hearing interview. So there are benefits to it. I will say that it is not uncommon that a complainant is frustrated. They come at the initial review and they speak to you. They might come at a formal interview and they speak to you. And then we tell them, now it's time for formal hearing, and it's not uncommon. I have to do this again? So that's something staff and I try to warn them about. But I'd also say, for that reason, you might think about that at the initial analysis, the initial review. Let's not, you know, this isn't the hearing. This isn't the formal interview or the hearing. It's just a time to know where you're going to send the matter. So maybe, you know, be cautious of that and don't make them tell their whole story three times if you can get enough info in the first time. Licensees receive a letter inviting them to the formal interview that tells them about the lessened due process rights. Staff sends that out. You don't need to, but they essentially are waiving their rights to more due process by proceeding in the formal interview.
If they pick the formal interview at the outset, then say, oh, no, I really want to go to formal hearing, you don't get two bites at the apple unless you as a board think the matter needs to be elevated to a formal hearing. But and there's actual case law on that.
At a formal interview, the main difference between formal interview and formal hearing is, other than the due process and the structure of the proceeding, is your disciplinary rights. So at formal interview, you can dismiss, you can file an advisory letter or a letter of reprimand, and you can issue the decree of censure, those minor kind of summaries of your findings. Or you can impose disciplinary probation, which can include, in this statutory quote, is terms that are, quote, best adapted to protect the public health, safety, and to rehabilitate and educate the licensee. So it's this kind of catch-all, hey, an order that you think protects the public and fixes the problem with the licensee. So you have some latitude, some discretion there on what to create, but you can only go up to 12 months of suspension. Otherwise, you need to go to formal hearing. You can impose practice restrictions. You know, you're not to treat this gender of patients or only in not a solo practice or an in-home practice. You can engage in practice restrictions. You can require restitution to the client for the fees paid for the services. And you can impose a civil penalty of up to $10,000 per violation. Or you can proceed to formal hearing, where the big difference is you have all of those tools as well, but also revocation or suspension. Obviously, if you ever have a really serious case that requires it, through any process, you have summary suspension, right? Summary suspension, we don't do many, just a quick reminder, is prior to any hearing or process, the license is suspended pending that hearing. The law is that you have to proceed promptly to a hearing, and we try and do it as quickly as possible. So case law had found that I think 60 days was too long. Usually we try and get in the next month. We also have notice problems, though. You're supposed to give 30 days notice before a formal hearing. So we do our best, if you ever do summarily suspend, to get the matter set as promptly as possible and mitigate the harm that comes to the licensee and having been disciplined with no hearing. But those can happen, and in your world, it may well be appropriate. Another option, just to throw it out there sometimes, is to have the licensee agree to suspend or voluntarily inactivate their license. Non-disciplinary investigative fashion, so that you don't need to take that step of that harsh suspension that's on their record. Sometimes people will disagree, hey, I'll shut it down for a little while rather than be suspended, which sounds worse and bad findings for me. Your non-disciplinary remedies, you have your advisory letters, and basically if there's insufficient evidence or the conduct at issue is not sufficiently serious to be disciplinary in nature, but it could result in more problems in the future. You're a little worried, hey, if you keep doing this, you're gonna have problems, but maybe this case wasn't it. And that's the type of case, by statute, really, that an advisory letter is appropriate. Continuing education. Mm-hmm. Probably a good idea to stay abreast of the courses that are available, and it sounds like you guys always are, but that's, you know, a very frequent tool. You can do non-disciplinary.
9:32. So you are running.
I think we're pretty much getting close to the end. I'll just wrap up what we have. For any disciplinary actions, you need findings of fact. You'll always have a complaint from which you can use to adopt or modify what you already have. I've seen you do that process yourself, so I know you're familiar with it. But it's important that you make the findings of fact, because the board has to draft the order, just like a consent agreement. We can't make it up. We have to base it on what you actually voted on. Licensees, after your disciplinary actions, have appeal rights. First, they come to you with their request for rehearing, and you're familiar with those. And if they don't like the result, and they have done a request for rehearing, they can appeal to Superior Court, and then from there to the Court of Appeals. The super short version. We obviously have these materials available for you. I have another handout that we didn't really get to that talks.
Sure. The texts and emails, and then we're going to let you go, just because it's important. You have a couple ones on conducting hearings, but when I went through it, I thought all of you did a really good job with that, so just read it over. But I think the way your hearings are set up, you're following all of that. One of the handouts is just on open meeting law and public records, and if you read it on your own, but the two issues I want to highlight, in the age of electronic communications, if you're using your personal cell phone and you text or email something, it's a public record if it regards board business. So I personally discourage texting anything about board business because it's hard to preserve a text. You know, there's a way to do it if you don't want to just keep it on your phone forever, but it is a public record. And I'm sure you've all seen news stories about that. Same thing with emails. If you're using a personal laptop, it's a public record and it needs to be maintained. So you can't go through and delete them. You can transfer them over to the board, but there has to be a way that if a public records request comes in, that document can be retrieved. I don't know if this happens a lot with you, but maybe with some of the bigger agencies, if a public records request comes in, what should happen is the executive director sends it to all the board members and says, please get me any documents that you think are responsive to this. So you send in whatever emails or if you have them. If you don't, then you just say, I don't have anything responsive. But just because you're not present in the board's official office doesn't mean that you're not subject to public records law. So that's something that's pretty important for all of you to know. The other thing is there's a public record gets confused with a record that can actually be provided to the public. So every record that is generated and maintained by the board as a whole that relates to the board's operations is a public record. But that doesn't necessarily mean that record is ever going to be to see the light of day. There's certain exceptions for obviously attorney-client communications. Certain things will not be disclosable, but they are still public records and have to be kept and maintained. If you read through that and you have any questions, you can call Michael and I, but those are the two things I'd like to highlight. A lot of the rest of it is something that staff deals with that you don't necessarily need to be involved in on a daily basis. Any questions on anything?
Thank you.
No? Thank you.
Very
good. I move that we adjourn the special meeting.
I second. Emily Clark.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Passes. Forgot the words already.
The motion passes unanimously.
Passes unanimously. Yes.